Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today originally aired in January of 2014, and here it is. Today, Adnan Zubairi joins me on the show. He's the producer of the movie 9/11 in the Academic Community, which won a University of Toronto Film Festival Award and which tackles the issue of why 9/11 discourse is taboo at universities in both Canada and the United States. Adnan Zubairi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Cheryl.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and then what got you interested in the 9/11 truth movement?
Sure. When I was an undergraduate student at the University of Waterloo, I was running a group called the University of Waterloo 9/11 Research Group. And the purpose of the group was to basically have gatherings with the general public, with students and professors of the university, to basically discuss much of the research that has been going on surrounding the events of September 11, 2001. And so it was an educational group, and we were trying to learn more about 9/11 and how it's impacted the world ever since. I learned some interesting things during my time as a student. I went around with other graduate students door-to-door, meeting with professors from different departments, talking to them about what I call critical perspectives on 9/11. That may not be terminology that other people within the movement pushing for an investigation for what happened on that fateful day may call it, but that's at least the words that I use. And I generally found that professors, there was definitely something in the atmosphere that was blocking the discussion in talking about critical perspectives on 9/11. And there was definitely a taboo there, which one is not able to discuss things like scientific evidence and things like that. And so I began to realize that no matter how good the evidence is, and even if it's published in the best journals, if there's a taboo there, the issue will not get any type of mainstream discussion. And so I began documenting the taboo itself. And ironically, I think this is kind of interesting, that it started getting interest from mainstream academics at the highest levels. I thought that was something very interesting. By talking with the taboo itself about the evidence, it has received much attention, has made its way into curriculum, and it continues to make its way into curriculum, I should say. So that's just an introduction.
And so from that research that you did, you were motivated to then do the film.
That's right. When I got to meet with people, I began to realize there's definitely a very peculiar phenomena. Professors, when we're students, they're very, well, at least we see them as godly personalities. They're supposed to guide us in research and in the classroom and how to think or how to do critical thinking. But suddenly when it came to this, I must say, unfortunately, I observed some very unusual behavior on their part. I would go in their offices and I would show them a couple of papers that have been published about critical perspectives on 9/11, and I would go through like a 30 seconds of silence period, become a frozen vegetable. I wouldn't know what to say, and they're kind of frozen as well. And from being people that are gods of lecturing in the classroom that can go on, they suddenly became silent. So I was like, wow. But the media brings on people like these who we believe to be that objective or unbiased, but they're actually enormous institutional pressures that may warp their thinking or silence them in certain ways that are quite subtle. They're not well documented, the pressures that are in the background. And so I thought it was important to document that.
What do you see as some of those pressures? Even though they're subtle, is there a way you can identify some of them for us?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because when it came to the types of pressures, let me just discuss how the taboo is handled and how the pressures come through an interaction of institutions. So I began recognizing that taboo exists mainly through two reasons. If people generally feel that something is an issue, then they try to voice their concerns about it. So if you go in academia and you try to say something like verbally in a speech, let's say, where generally you make yourself quite public by saying that, you know, I read the official story, the official commission report, I read it in detail and found out that at the crux of it, you know, what they tell us about 9/11, it's based on torture testimony, and then the person they tortured to get this entire story about what happened on 9/11, that person said that he just made it up because he's just trying to free himself from the torture. And then the tapes that had the so-called recorded torture testimony, the Central Intelligence Agency then destroyed many of those tapes. So you begin to realize, wow, what are these are some major violations of scholarship. This is 10 times worse than plagiarism. So, and that's the approach I take, but even if one says things like that in a very public way, a storm comes on you in academia. So if you verbally discuss something, basically you have so many academics that come chasing after you. I documented one case of this. It was John McMurtry, who was perhaps the foremost ethical philosopher in Canada. He's a very distinguished academic here. And there were his own friends at Harvard wrote a letter to him. Okay, I still can't believe this to this day. They notified him that they're reporting him to the FBI and the CIA for basically raising some very good questions. And so if you speak out about it, then there will be major pressures from academics. Then if you try the second approach, which is, okay, let me sit down and do the so-called scholarly practice, which is to gather my research, do my fact-checking, and submit it in a paper to a journal. So this is the second phenomenon I documented. Basically, there's lots of papers. There's over 20 papers now in peer-reviewed journals in different fields, from economics and engineering and the humanities and social sciences. And there's 20 papers there, and there's zero discussion. There's just no circulation of...
And these 20 papers challenge the official story of 9/11.
Yeah, they come under what I call critical perspectives on 9/11. And okay. So they will be questioning things like, how can you base this entire story on torture?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when the person says he just made it up. Or engineering issues with the buildings and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
In that what we observed and how rapidly the buildings came down, when you actually do an analysis in structural dynamics, it shows that buildings don't come down that way, and that was published by professors that I know in structural engineering. And so these are really important things. I think one paper that really stands out in the highest journals is a paper by Alan Potashman. He's a professor of mathematical finance at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he was given confidential data by the Securities and Exchange Commission because they themselves may have been curious about whether there was unusual market activity going on in the days leading up to 9/11, meaning someone may have possibly had some idea that these airliners would be going into the buildings, and so someone made a lot of money off of it by purchasing put options, which are in a way bets about which way the markets will go pertaining to those options, and you can make a lot of money if you're right about those predictions. And it was unprecedented in terms of that type of market activity, and so they gave him confidential data. And Professor Potashman did what an academic does. He got right to the chase, and he did his analysis, and it's a probabilistic analysis. Mm-hmm. And he concluded that something to the order of 99% there was insider trading on those airlines. And now it was published in the Journal of Business, which is a publication of a very high impact factor. I mean, it's a really well-regarded, it's a business school publication.
Mm-hmm.
It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Anyone who knows anything about universities knows that University of Chicago has so many Nobel Prize winners associated with it. It's a very major university. And to have a paper published on their name like that, and it got zero attention. And this is the point that Professor Zaremka makes, is like, it's extraordinary. You can write a paper about, you know, if you have the death penalty, does it increase or decrease the probability of crime? You're going to have hundreds of academics that will be publishing papers in support of you or against you. There'll be a lot of debate. And now here we have something even of much greater importance, and there's zero discussion. And so if you speak out about it, you get punished. If you do the scholarly practice of publishing papers, then there's zero discussion. If this was the case with, like, let's say, a medical science activity, let's say there's something, you're doing some research on cancer, you speak out about it, you get in trouble. If you publish about it, no one talks to you. You definitely realize that there's something wrong here.
Right, because this is a defining event of our times, and for people to ignore it is pretty amazing.
So there's a taboo there. So when it comes to institutional pressures, I mean, it has to do with more of the first case. When a university or professors within the university start speaking out about it, this is what happened to Professor William Woodward at the University of New Hampshire. And basically what happened was that many students rallied to get him fired when he expressed his opinion that the Bush administration may have allowed the 9/11 attacks to go forward. And basically what happened was that there are pressures that cascade down. They basically come through an interaction of institutions. And the other institution I'm referring to is, of course, those of political parties and government. And basically it comes down to threatening the funding of universities, especially if they're like state-funded universities. And so they said that in their next legislative meetings that they'll actually discuss the university's budget if that professor is not fired by that time. And so the university was able to quietly cut a deal, maintain his professorship. And those are tough times. And so there are, behind the university, there's also the government. And if a university does ever stick out its neck, too many of its professors come out on this issue, then there will be some really serious repercussions. So a lot of my time goes into not just documenting these things, but in actually working out a larger framework with professors on how to proceed strategically with allowing critical perspectives on a variety of issues concerning the origins of war, how to go forward with them, and how to make pathways into curriculum.
That sounds great. Now, I know some of these same professors were free to criticize the Bush administration for the lies they told to take us into the war in Iraq, and they were against our civil liberties being taken away by the Patriot Act, but that they won't go near 9/11, and that always seems quite interesting to me, because we know that Bush lied to us about going into the war in Iraq, and even one of the lies was to connect it to 9/11, Saddam Hussein to 9/11. So why do you suppose they feel safe doing that, but not going as far as 9/11?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's paradoxical, isn't it, Cheryl?
Yes.
I mean, you have academics who are very critical of government administrations about how they take us to war. There are academics who believe that many wars are based on lies, they're based on flimsy evidence, they're war crimes. But 9/11 is an exception. 9/11 does not deserve any type of critical inquiry and so forth. I know there is a distinguished professor of political science at Yale University, who I'm in touch with at the moment. His name is Charles Lindblom, and he was also examining many forms of literature. And this is an exceptional individual, by the way, in that he was looking at so much literature and how people discuss things, how academics discuss things. And he was looking at a broader form of it. A lot of people say that the reason why these things happen is because people are indoctrinated to emphasize certain things and de-emphasize other things. But he was looking at more subtle forms of indoctrination, which is like self-induced. He calls these impairments, that there's a broader type of issue in inquiry called impairment, and that people are, he quoted someone called Leo Szilard, who was a nuclear scientist. Upon visiting the U.S., he said that, it was quite a famous line that exemplifies this phenomenon of impairment. He said, "Americans are free to say what they think, but they do not think what they are not free to say." So it was a very powerful line, and it's not just applicable to Americans, but intellectuals around the world, where they're free to say what they think. They'll even say some very controversial things, but the very things that they are not free to say, and which their entire credibility may vanish in a second, they just don't think those things. And yet those are the very issues that are the originating sources of many of today's most major problems, like the war on terror. And more to that, I think a lot of people spend time on Chomsky, saying he is the main example of a person who has these type of impairments. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
One can read his book. It was his best seller, called 9/11. That's the name of his book. And in his book, the documentary also points this out, Chomsky says that even though the evidence against the perpetrators of 9/11 was really thin, and even though the anthrax was found to be coming from a U.S. bioweapons laboratory, let's presume that the official story is still correct. And, you know, and people even reading his books, the followers of Chomsky and academics on the left, I'm not even sure if they blink when they read that. They're like, what? What did he just say? Despite all these things, let's just presume it to be correct. And so there are these forms of impairments that are there in professional, in academic inquiry. And so we're making, in discussing things along these lines, I found that sociologists are, when I speak to them through email about using the word impairment and discussing it in more detail, they seem to be catching on. So even though I'm everything I'm saying has a very negative aspect to it, but there's a lot of positive progress being made in discussing these.
Now, do you think it's safer for Canadian professors to discuss this in the academic setting than American professors? Because I noticed, like, even with the Toronto hearings, it was a lot of Canadian professors that were driving that effort. So I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it might be easier by 1%.
Okay.
I'm aware of the issues surrounding certain Canadian academics as well, and we're almost no different than American universities, at least from what I've seen.
Oh, interesting.
It's really weird, isn't it? But even though I'm aware of here up north, we're very similar to American universities in many ways, in how we socialize, the pressures that act on us.
Right, the same media manipulation and all of that.
Yeah, and we saw what happened to Professor John McMurtry. Wow, I mean, he got it very rough.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of academics asking for him to be fired.
Was he able to keep his position?
He was, but that's also because he was a part of the Royal Society of Canada. He was promoted to the title of Distinguished Professor of the university, which only 4 or 5 people have out of all the thousands of academics there. So they eventually decided, okay, let's let him keep his job under some pretense of academic freedom. And I think the university still did a good job, but they could have done more. But if it wasn't for those distinctions that he had...
Yeah, I think he's amazing. I've heard him. I've played some of his speeches on the radio show. He's just got such a way with language.
Never had those type of honors. I think there could have been a possibility where he may have been removed.
Mm-hmm.
I know another professor in Canada who just wrote an article, which was a very, very well-written article about critical perspectives on 9/11. And it wasn't about any type of wild conspiracy theories, but it was just discussing problems inherent in the commission report. He was right during an interview with another university. The first question they asked in the job interview was, do you think 9/11 was an inside job? And so when we talk about our Canadian universities, do they have it any easier than American? I would say no.
Why do you think academics should be interested in 9/11 at all anyway? What's their role? Why would they need to be interested in this, or should they? What's their role in society?
I think that there are many answers one can give to this as to why, because there's so many different departments in academia, different disciplines. We can discuss why engineers should be interested, why political scientists should be interested. So let me try to just focus on one group of academics, let's say social scientists.
Okay.
That will kind of get the idea across. So the example I was giving was, when it comes to institutions of education, you may remember growing up, Cheryl, that plagiarism was a very, very bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you plagiarize, that's the end of your scholarly reputation and so on and so forth. And that's still the way many educational institutions are, and in a way it's good that they emphasize that. But here we have something that's 10 times bigger than just plagiarism. We have here a piece of work, the 9/11 Commission Report, which is almost 600 pages, and it was at its very crux of how the entire operation of 9/11 happened, how these men were, alleged 19 hijackers were chosen by bin Laden in the cave in Afghanistan and all these things. Basically, this whole thing came from torture testimony. And when you have the person, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, I was looking at the back of the 9/11 Commission Report. I was going through its citations. It's absolutely extraordinary. It just says KSM, meaning Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They got this info from him. And pages just go on and on. KSM, KSM, KSM. So if you're cited that many times, you must be the most famous scholar in the world, okay? But this guy was basically cited throughout the commission report. It was through almost 183 waterboardings in 1 month. He was told that one of his family members might be killed or a whole number of things. And he told the ICRC, the Red Cross, that he just made stuff up. And so here's a story. It's proposed to us as a form of scholarship. It's put in a book with a really small print. This is the point that Graham McQueen makes. And it's based on something that makes plagiarism look extremely small. Professors, why should they be interested? The answer to the question is, this is an abuse. This is anti-scholarship. it doesn't have just to do with 9/11. If anyone does this with any type of major world event and starts changing domestic and foreign policies for the worse, not for the better, we're scaling back civil liberties and things like that, based on an assault on a scholarship, every academic since the foundation of the scholarship is how they've based their entire lives around, built their lives around, they need to be involved that way. And which is exactly how I'm able to get people who specialize in the philosophy of ethics, the ethics of torture, and so forth, to get them to view the film from that light. And so it is, at the same time, I should say that there's a lot of good news that there is interest from these type of angles. It's just most of them don't know about it. So when it comes to the general public, I would say that it's extremely important that they are connected to their educational institutions on this topic. There are three institutions that have failed us. The media has failed us. Political parties have failed us. And the universities have overall also failed us on this subject. But we are making more progress with universities, the institution of universities, than we are with the other two institutions. And this is the best progress we're making so far, in my own opinion. And so I feel that it's important that we talk to students and professors and that we have their support on this. Credibility is really important. They're not people who have formal power, like access to changing policy and stuff like that, but they have a lot of, as Graham McQueen has said, they have like informal power through high status in society, credibility, and influence. And if they were all to get together, a great majority of academics, they could actually stop this whole war machine.
Ah, you really think so? That's interesting.
Yeah, and just to give a very quick example, back in the late 1930s, the preeminent professor of philosophy, Martin Heidegger, he's known for providing the foundations for existentialism, which is a branch in philosophy and metaphysics. And right after becoming president of the University of Heidelberg in Germany, in just 2 weeks of becoming president, at the very time the German people were having doubts about the sophistication and intellect of the Nazis, Professor Heidegger, he announced his support for the Nazi Party. And basically it sent a wave of intellectual legitimization across Germany in intellectual circles, and it just gave the Nazis a free path to walk right into the universities. Academics are a very small portion of our society, but they play enormous roles. We don't notice this, but they play enormous roles. Even if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, what government official in the right mind is going to write up a 600-page report? They don't. They get academics to do it. They got Philip Zelikow, who is right now a distinguished professor of history and associate dean of the graduate studies at the University of Virginia, to write the report. They get academics to do these. And so I think they are a very small sector of society, but we need to specialize in understanding how to communicate with them and how to get them into the right direction.
Now, you have a website for the movie. Could you tell the audience what that is and what they might find there?
Sure. The website is 911inacademia.com, and from there they can learn more about the documentary. I must say that I'm sorry at the moment if I've halted the sales of the film, as I'm trying to use the profits to send out films to professors. It's not so much of a public approach, where most activism relies on the conventional approach of getting the word out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually doing the exact opposite, which is it's a large-scale private approach. And perhaps that's the very reason why we're having some unprecedented success that way, where just about any professor I speak to, they do respond back with a very positive word, and it makes its way into the classroom. I've seen it just happen so many times that I would welcome people to help out, if they're interested, in a large-scale private approach.
And what kind of a response have you had so far to the film, other than what you've just shared with us?
I guess there's many ways we can discuss this, like endorsements, where people write recommendations for the film. These are people who are new to this line of inquiry. They have not had the time to look into this in the past. And they're not just any professors, they're very high-ranking professors. One example would be Roger W. Bowen. This man served as the president of the State University of New York at one of their major campuses, and he saw the film, and he wrote an endorsement for it. That's pretty high up in the academy. I sent it to a person who just finished his term as president of the American Association of University Professors. This person has also held defense fellowships and sent it to him. And he wrote an email that he wrote a confession in the email saying that for some reason, perhaps due to my own lack of thinking or due to the U.S.-centric media, I was not able to think of these type of things. And that's exactly what we were talking about earlier, Cheryl, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Impairments that people do not think what they are not free to say. And so there are these forms of external indoctrinations and self-induced indoctrinations that accumulate into this broader form of impairment and inquiry. And now there are people who have served as pretty high up in the directorate of the White House Terrorism Task Force, others in the Senate Intelligence Committee, and at least in Canada, people who have served as presidents of the Royal Society of Canada, and so forth. I've received responses from many people in these categories, and they've been very, very positive, and it's made its way into curriculum at many universities in Canada in engineering classes.
Oh, fantastic.
In the sociology of terrorism classes at the University of Western Ontario, that's a direct example there, has received perfect feedback. You know, whenever we write an essay, there's some grumpy teacher who always just takes a couple marks off, doesn't want to give 100.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, I'm surprised that it's received perfect feedback, and there's a distinguished professor of law at the University of Iowa who will be showing it to his law school class, and so it's definitely getting out there. I have trouble keeping up with it.
Now, we're almost out of time, Adnan. Is there anything that you'd like the listeners to know that we haven't already talked about?
I would encourage people to think in a different way about how to make progress on this most difficult topic. That many of us rely on a public approach, trying to get stuff into the newspapers. And if you write something in newspapers, the very next day the media just reverts back to the language of the dominant official narrative. And so when these institutions fail and our approaches fail, public approaches, trying to get the word out, I would encourage a different way of thinking about how private social relations can be worked up the ladder to try to change things. And I would encourage people to contact me as to how that is being done and how we can work with that.
Okay, and they can contact you through the website.
Absolutely.
911inacademia.com.
Yes. It was a real pleasure to be on your show, Cheryl.
Yes, it was a real pleasure having you on the show, Adnan. And thanks for all your work in creating the movie 9/11 in the Academic Community. And again, the show you just heard originally aired in January of 2014. You can get a copy of the film 9/11 in Academia at the website 911inacademia.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.